Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Each of us came into this world and into this body as a spirit, a soul, from the realm of timelessness, from the dimension of unity, as Rumi says in the opening of the Mesnevi. You are a reed that has been plucked from the reed bed, and the reed makes an excellent flute, and the music that's played on this reed is with the breath of God, and the music that is played by the soul that is conscious and empty enough is a song of yearning, a beautiful yearning for our origin, and a yearning that comforts both the happy and the sad and touches the soul deeply. But in coming into this world, we also take on the attributes of the world, and especially the attributes of the animal body, the physical form that is our vehicle in this world. And there are lots of ways that traditions talk about this. But it's best if we can see it and experience it for ourselves and realize that we are of two natures. One nature is of the transcendently spiritual. It's our consciousness. It's all of our highest sentiments. And then there's another aspect of ourselves that is of this body, of this mammalian and even reptilian nature that we embody. And there's presumably a purpose to this meeting of these two conditions. Certainly in our tradition, we don't denigrate the body and we don't see it as something that needs to be tortured or treated as an extreme ascetic would treat it. But the attitude is more one of training the body and bringing spiritual energy into the body and not being enslaved by the body. So these are things we have to notice and pay attention to and sense for ourselves. When are we being enslaved by the body? When are we, in a sense, giving it too much control over our lives and especially over our spirit? Rumi says, don't make Jesus carry your donkey. Let your donkey carry your Jesus. Too often we are the humble, beautiful Jesus lugging around the donkey of the body, trying to meet its needs and desires, which are sometimes stupid and often never satisfied. Another way that it's described is that we are, by Rumi, and I think this goes back also to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that we are the marriage of an angel and a donkey. We're half angel and we're half donkey. And if we allow our donkeyness to prevail, then we are worse than any beast. If we allow our angelic nature to prevail, then we have a state far beyond the angels. Because the angels do what they do by their nature. They have no will, they have no choice. They just glorify God automatically. It's all they can do. But the human being is always working in a sense, in a polarity with these other forces. And I reiterate, those forces are not to be viewed as something satanic or dark or negative, though things can move in that direction if they move to that extreme. But presumably there is a beautiful purpose to being embodied and coming into this world of experience, of sense experience and relationship and nature, for instance. The beauty, intelligence, the sublimity of nature is something that is part of the joy of life. It's also a big part of the revelation of the Quran. The Quran again and again and again says, you know, it doesn't talk about beliefs, it doesn't offer any, shall we say, fantastic theology or irrational propositions. It simply says, look at the signs of nature. And these signs is a message for hearts that reflect. So even nature is a communication of the divine. It's interesting to note historically, I mean, the significance of this, the importance of it cannot be underestimated. In our Western Christian tradition, until approximately the time of Thomas Aquinas, there was virtually no concept that the human being could learn anything about the divine from this world or from nature. It was just not part of the package. The only access to the divine was through the church, or of course through church mediating the grace of Jesus. And I don't want to get into the theology too unnecessarily deeply, but it was through Aquinas and his contact with classical sources and Islamic sources especially that the notion that we can learn about the divine through the signs of this world came into our own Western tradition. Returning back to our situation, which is the important point here tonight, there are so many spiritual practices that essentially aim to awaken a part of ourselves that may tend to fall asleep in the body or be subsumed in the desires and habits of the body. There are practices of fasting in all traditions. In fact, fasting is really an underappreciated method of spiritual attainment in our culture. We have dieting, but we don't have fasting very much. And yet all of the great saints and prophets have put a big emphasis on this, that it really leads to a spiritualization of consciousness in its due proportion. Not fasting all the time, but fasting as part of a spiritual practice. Night vigil, not oversleeping too much, or sometimes breaking the habit of being asleep and awakening against your will to be, in a sense, to awaken that part of ourselves that is meant to be the master of the body. The body is not meant to master us. It doesn't mean there aren't times when we need to listen to our bodies, right? And say, well, the body's saying, take a rest. Okay, you know, I get you, body. I'll give you some rest. But then we have to know, well, when is it just laziness and when is it a real need? Spirit has to know this. So we are this marriage of the angelic and donkeyhood. And our theme this month, which I hope we'll find practical ways to practice in addition to your regular spiritual practice of meditation and zikr, that you'll also find all kinds of opportunities to awaken in life. maybe doing something practical, like washing dishes or sweeping the floor or tending to a patient. Sometimes in relationship, in consulting with others, allow that space of presence to open up in the midst of all of these activities. Bring in awareness of the breath, really simple practice, to establish something beyond just that narrow identification with your thoughts or whatever your attention is focused on. Learn to exercise your attention. For most people in this culture who have almost no occasion for training the soul or for cultivating a spiritual discipline, attention is simply a reaction to whatever's going on out there and whatever draws our attention. And the whole world is competing for our attention. And politics is competing, and materialism is competing, and mass media and entertainment is competing to suck up every bit of attention we have and to use it for its own purposes. And the greater purpose, a sinister purpose, may simply be to keep us asleep and enslaved in the stupidity of all of these idolatries and compulsions and dependencies. Now I'm going to shift a little bit. That's the practical side. That's what we do most every week. You know, we focus on the real practical side of what this work is. So I'm reminding us. And tonight I'm going to try and go a little bit further, you might say, intellectually, historically, to try and give something of an overview of Sufism and what its vision is and what it is meant to accomplish. I have to start with the prophetic voice, the prophetic consciousness. Jesus was such a prophetic consciousness. Solomon, David, Abraham, others we could name, and countless we cannot name. But of those we know, the prophetic consciousness, the prophetic vision, is both a critique of, as I said, the idolatries of society or civilization. Society and civilization, which is often just a compounding of our collective neuroses, although we would like to say that every true civilization begins with a mystic somewhere. I think that we can say it is so. We could prove that all true civilizations, if they're worth the name, begin with an inspiration of something from the higher world. But that doesn't mean that the collectivity of society or civilization doesn't often and typically, almost lawfully, degenerate into collective neurosis, even psychosis. I mean, you know, look at Europe in the 20th century. I could say, look at the Arab world now. But look at Europe in the 20th century. how many hundreds of millions of people died violently because of the violence of so-called civilization. It's the prophetic voice and the prophetic vision that stands in opposition to this. It's not the cause of it, whatever Bill Maher may say. You know, the prophetic voice that offers a critique of this violence, of this stupidity, of this dark unconscious conflict and exploitation, etc., etc. Don't need to go into the details of all of that to make our point. At the same time, even more importantly, the prophetic vision is one that points us toward divine reality and reminds us of our angelic or spiritual nature and of our donkey nature too. But the important thing is to remind us that we can live in such a way as to maximize our movement toward that reality, or to awaken a greater consciousness of that reality. And it's done through true worship. By worship we don't mean necessarily rituals and ceremonies. We mean a reverencing of the divine, which is facilitated by certain forms, of course, and also by collective behavior. True worship is one of the greatest human activities, as rare as it may be. We get preached to in mosques and churches, and we attempt to worship, but we may not know how. We may not be taught how to truly be in a state of communion with the divine. This is what the prophets wanted to convey to us, and do convey to us. And this is our heritage. This is the heritage of Sufism. It's especially the heritage of Sufism, I would like to say, in our case, it's also the heritage of Islam and of any true religion. But let's talk a little bit about Sufism in the context of Islam, just as an educational matter. Sufi tradition uses the vocabulary, the basic revelation of the Quran, the basic practices exemplified by the Prophet Muhammad, and other practices that were part of a living esoteric tradition that came through the Prophet Muhammad, not from him, through him, truly through divine inspiration or through a higher intelligence, however you want to describe it, but a living esoteric tradition, as well as the exoteric practices such as the ritual prayer and fasting and pilgrimage and these things, which at least in Islam are still very much close to the inner essence. They are potentially a beautiful vehicle for carrying the inner essence, which is all about communion with the divine. The purpose of all of this is communion with the divine. If it's not that, what is it? What good is it? That's its purpose. It's a spiritual training system to awaken human beings to communion with the Absolute. Various things happen to Islam. You know, there's, from the early years, there was a division between the Sunni stream and the Shia stream. There was conflict. You could view that conflict as a kind of failure, in part. Failure isn't the whole story by any means, There was a lot of beauty. There was a lot of holiness. There was a lot of virtue. But there was also conflict and even violence. The Sunnis focused on tradition as a historic template, as something almost frozen in time. Here it is. We've got to, you know, preserve this thing that happened at the time of Muhammad. And then not too much later, they had what's called the closing of the gates of Ijtihad, which means the closing of the gates of interpretation of all of the Quran and everything else, where certain people, actually it was never a formal proclamation, it was more or less described in retrospect, but Islamic Sunni scholars said, we've answered every question that could possibly be asked, it's all done, it's all decided, there's nothing more to talk about. From the Sufi perspective, this immobilized the religion and caused stagnation. The more it became associated with an institutional clerical establishment, even more so. And in recent centuries, particularly the last 4 or 5 centuries, predominantly a stagnant situation. Except for the mystics, except for the Sufis, who, by the way, are formidable, a very formidable presence. They're not fighting it out with the mainstream. It's not their business. They have their own work of transformation to do. Well, you have the Sunnis who, as I said, they saw tradition as something fixed. And the preservation of that which was fixed was their primary objective. And they developed certain beliefs around this. Welcome, welcome. They developed certain beliefs around this, certain propositions, certain teachings about the Quran and how to understand the Quran and about the Prophet and how to view the Prophet, such things as the importance of the Prophet's Sunnah and imitating his behavior and all these other things. But very much it was a focus on things, behaviors, the outer manifestation of something that was primarily an inner phenomenon, a transformative phenomenon. That's the Sunni world. The Shia world was a little bit different. In some ways, the Gnostic energy of Islam was in some ways maybe a little bit better preserved for a while in the Shia world, because they saw it as a living stream. They didn't see it as all kind of completely fixed and done, you know, at the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him. They, through the generations of the Prophet's family, the Ahli Bayt, they're called, the people of the house, the Imams, they believed that there was a living tradition of interpretation. But they said, basically they said, only the Imams can interpret, nobody else. Only the Imams know. And that became even more and more of a, shall we say, more authoritarian. Till we have what we have in Iran today, which is a teaching called Vilayati Fiqh. It's one of the premises of Shiism in Iran, which is only those with the proper authority in the Shia hierarchy have the right to tell you what the Quran means. I was invited to a peace conference in Tehran, Islam and World Peace, maybe about 8 or 10 years ago, and I'd written out my speech. And it was going to be there with, you know, really top leaders of Iran and so forth. And in fact, the speech turned out it was the opening speech, along with the vice president of Iran at that time. But I showed it to an old friend of ours, an old Iranian Mevlevi Sheikh, and he read my talk at the dinner table, and he got a little bit white, and he put the paper down, and he said, "I implore you, Kabir, not to read this paragraph, because either you or people associated with this event are going to be in big trouble." Because it was, in my own naive American sensibility, it was a head-on confrontation with the Laetific. It was saying we cannot give over entirely to any religious authority a monopoly on interpretation of truth. And he begged me to take that paragraph out. I took it out of the speech. I left it in the published version, which is on our website. But this is the attitude. This is what it has become. This is what human beings do to something that is meant to be a living tradition. And yet, we find in the Imams and the Ahlul Bayt and great figures like Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, for instance, who was a great teacher of the Sufis. He was, almost a couple of centuries after the Prophet, not quite. And he educated many Sunni and so-called Shia people, and many of the Sufi lineages come through the great teachings of this nominally Shia Imam. So we owe a lot to them, of so much beauty. And deep esotericism came through this stream. Now we take a step back and we bring in the Sufi vision, the Sufi perspective, which is accept the practices, the model of the Prophet in his worship, in his character, accept the revelation of the Quran, but understand that this is not a rigid belief system fixed once and for all, and that in fact our greatest interpretation of this revelation and our understanding of it is facilitated by the great saints who have reached realization. People like Rumi, Ibn Arabi, Abdul Qadir Gilani, and I could name many, many, many more. Human beings who reached completion and through whom the interpretation of the Quran or the illumination of the Quran and the embodiment of the Quran is possible, is actualized. There's a term in Islam called the living Quran. They say the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was the living Quran. They asked his wife Aisha, what was the Prophet like? She said he was like the Quran. And then we look at his close, nephew and one of his closest companions, Imam Ali, great historical figure whose letter to Ashtar, which delineates a theory of governance when Ashtar was going to be the governor of Egypt, and Ali wrote a 40-page letter telling Ashtar how to govern a community of people who were not all Muslims, they were a mixed group. And it really is one of the great documents of political science. If you want to read something that will absolutely inspire you with its sense of justice and beauty and humility and care for the poor and very sharp insights on how to sustain justice, you find it in Ali's letter to Ashtar. Nobody was closer to the Prophet than Imam Ali. Yet when you read these, it's about 40 book pages, you read Ali, and you find that he's not quoting the Quran, he's not quoting Hadith, he's speaking from his own being, from his own wisdom. Yes, it's the wisdom that has been shaped by these decades of revelation and companionship with the Prophet and the other companions and everything that was learned. But he doesn't feel the need to say, as it says in Surah 5, verse 22, he never says that. He refers only a couple of times to the Quran and in general to the Prophet. Instead, he's speaking from his own wisdom, from his heart, a wisdom that's very alive, a wisdom that's very just. He says things like, don't ever let the powerful concerns of a small minority cause you to overlook the needs of the many who are poor. So Imam Ali, in these words, really demonstrates that he was transformed. He was a true Sufi. He is, in fact, absolutely in the lineage of almost all the Sufi orders traced back through Ali. So the Sufi perspective is the prophetic vision, the vision that is a critique of all of the idolatries that society inevitably erects. It is standing up against injustice, rigorously opposing injustice on the social level. And at the same time, its main focus is really knowingness. It's a gnosis. Because without this gnosis, without this deep perception of the divine reality, all these other things are going to go wrong, one way or the other. Or we're going to get sidetracked, or it's going to turn into something shallow or compromised or expedient. Without that deep knowing. And so the Sufis, they live in a Quranic world. Their memory is, there's a term called the Quranization of memory. Their internal cognitive processes are shaped by propositions like, indeed, in the remembrance of God, hearts find rest, for instance, or wheresoever you look is the face of God. But it's a living wisdom, a living tradition that always has an eye open for theophany. Theophany means the revelation of the divine. I mean, this is all of it. All of this reality is a revelation of the divine. All of this reality is theophany to the one who can see. So it's for the Sufis, who are the true heirs of this tradition. They are the ones who did not sacrifice that knowingness to either an authoritarian belief systems or authoritarian interpreters who will tell us what everything means. They're the ones who teach the method and the way for us to attain that knowingness with some guidance, of course, within certain parameters, within certain propositions that are not to be accepted as belief systems, but as empirical, you know, as propositions to be tested and validated empirically. You take something like, indeed, in the remembrance of God, hearts find rest. Well, find out if that's true or not. Some other way to attain tranquility, if you know what it is, go for it. At least try to know what remembrance of God is, and what that might be. So this few more words about this tradition. It is not an alien cultural tradition that stands apart from our own Western Judeo-Christian tradition, or for that matter, from even the traditions of the East. Although it's more allied, it's more within the, it's absolutely within the context of the Judeo-Christian lineage. Not as something other, alien, and separate, but honestly as a critique within that tradition. It proposes that certain things have gone wrong in our understanding of the message of the prophets of our Judeo-Christian tradition, certain things that have been distorted and that can be realigned in order to be in true alignment with the authenticity of these beautiful messengers that have come to our world. So it comes back to, we'll come back to where we began. Each of us is half angel and half donkey. If the angelic prevails, the human being is greater than any angel because you have free will. You chose it, the angel didn't. And if we instead predominantly serve our donkeyness, we're not even an animal. An animal is blessed. Every animal is following the will of God. But a human being who follows his or her animal nature is bestial, not animal. Animals are following their true destiny. They worship God in their own way, and the appropriate way for an animal. But they don't have free will. They don't have a degree of self-awareness, or, as is our theme this month, consciousness, aware of itself, is a divine gift. God bless our beloved pets, dogs, cats, horses, etc., etc., who have their own kind of intelligence, without a doubt, and their own sensory capacities that are absolutely extraordinary. But there's something unique left for the human being to accomplish. It's to know our source and know our origin consciously. And this is our practice, moment by moment, in whatever we do. It's not a practice that causes us to stop doing other things. It is a practice that encompasses everything we do and makes everything sacred. From marriage to livelihood, to our religious activities. So this theme of this month, consciousness aware of itself, which a couple of weeks ago we equated with the Arabic term marifa, knowingness, gnosis. Gnosis is awakening of that capacity to be self-aware, and in being self-aware, it's not that self-awareness is the final end of this, it's more the beginning, really. It's a big beginning. It's a big task in and of itself to truly know yourself and to know that in some respects our own worst enemy is between our ribs. Unless our spiritual nature prevails. If our ego prevails, We spend our lives finding faults out there, finding faults with others, never really looking at our own, never seeing how our own faults play into our disappointments, our problems, our resentments. But if we follow this thread of consciousness being aware of itself, it inevitably takes us through stages of the enlargement of consciousness. One of our beloved friends, Abdulaziz Saeed, the oldest professor at American University right now, great peace worker, he defines spirituality as establishing the largest possible context. It's a pretty good definition. But not intellectually, experientially. So if we follow this thread, or we follow this consciousness, it inevitably accumulates, shall we say, or augments upon itself and grows to the point where you realize you are the drop that contains the ocean. Every human being is a hologram of the universe. Now we have a metaphor for this, or it's not even a metaphor, it's a reality. Everybody knows what a hologram is. Well, Sufis have known about holograms for a long time. Yunus Emre said, you are the drop that contains the ocean, not the drop that dissolves in the ocean. Forget that. It's a cliche. You are the drop that contains the whole ocean. Consciousness, aware of itself, knows this. And I think that's next month's theme, actually. So this is what it leads to. It leads to a cosmic awareness that transforms how we see everything and how we experience our relationships. How we experience nature. How we experience our problems, our challenges, our disappointments, our sufferings. The whole nature of suffering is transformed in this. Not escaped, not neutralized, but transformed. The suffering of the human being who knows that all that happens, happens within the context of profound divine mercy. Finds that even the pain and disappointment of life takes on a different meaning. So I'll just stop here and this is the only meeting we've had where I didn't pass out a piece of paper to look at. And but I wanted to try and bring this larger picture to us tonight and give you something to reflect on in the weeks when we will be away, but also remind us of what the very practical work is. Have I been, you know, like repeated myself enough, enough times on just this one theme? And also to convey something, it's just a bit of sketchy narration of the place of Sufism, I won't even say within Islamic tradition, I'll say within the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. Because I believe it has a very privileged place and has been able to keep certain things alive because of its emphasis on the knowingness of the individual, of cultivating that, of affirming the need, the importance of direct experience, and the direct experience that comes through the purification of consciousness, purification of the heart. And what we are aiming for is the purification and transformation of every one of yourselves that are here, of every one of you and your very selves, to become something more luminous, something more free of negativity, free of egoism, something capable of greater humility and love and relationship. And it's a practical task that requires knowledge as well as sincerity and practice. This is our path. And Rumi says the same thing, but in 50,000 verses, in several thousand pages. Did I leave you with any questions? Any objections? Any arguments? Yes.
Clearly, there are Shia countries predominantly, Shia countries predominantly, Sunni countries. Are there existing now Sufi societies, countries, regions, persistent communities within the country? And if so, how well have they done at keeping the focus on cultivating luminous souls rather than maintaining rigid adherence to ritual? And how well have the sheikhs, the leaders, done at remaining as spiritual midwives rather than rituals?
Imperfectly. They've done their task imperfectly. And but there are many Sufis, even in the most inhospitable conditions. There are many Sufis in Saudi Arabia, for instance. You wouldn't expect it. A book has just been published. I haven't read it yet, but we were talking about it today with Mahmoud. It's called Signs on the Horizons, or of the Horizons, Signs on or of the Horizons, by an American. And it particularly talks about contemporary Sufi sheikhs in the Arab world, including in Saudi Arabia. And some very beautiful souls that this person has met and spent time with. There are Sufis in Iran. I mean, Saudi Arabia and Iran would be the most inhospitable places in the world today, in the world, for Sufis, except maybe for China. But in China, you could probably be more anonymous. And yet they're there. They're everywhere. And at the same time, do people get corrupted by power and authority? Sure. There are very clear examples of this, and sometimes the best known of, you know, the more fame, the more danger, the more.
What are some of the hints for Sufism or region where Sufism predominates, or is very well-established part of the mix?
It's strong in Turkey. It was very strong in Syria. West Africa. Morocco. Mali. Yeah, Mali. A lot of Africa. I mean, Africa is predominantly a Sufi culture. Things have changed in recent decades because the money from the Gulf, literally hundreds of billions of dollars, have gone into basically mind control activities throughout the world. And this has caused great harm to the spiritual life in Pakistan, for instance. What?
Where there were men.
Where Sufism also had once predominated, and where now it's not, you know, these people are organized and they have very strong beliefs and they convey those beliefs to mostly ignorant people. So this is a situation at this moment. It's not a good situation. And yet it's not quite Europe in the 20th century, thank God. It's not that bad. And I personally believe people are going to get exhausted by this false religion because it brings them nothing. It doesn't bring them happiness. It doesn't bring well-being. It brings maybe self-righteousness and a bit of a adrenaline high for a while. But it's no lasting benefit. One day, though, people will go back to the old ways, I believe. Or the new ways, better yet. You know, I often quote this very important verse from the Quran that warns Muslims, if you fail to keep this religion, God says, if you fail to keep this religion, you can be replaced. You'll be replaced with people who will love God and whom God will love. It's that simple.